Well, our time has come, and I'd like to say hello, everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Professor Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to the teleclass, Human Factors Engineering Applications for Infection Prevention and Control. The name Dr. Hugo Sachs is one that you probably already know, and if you don't, you certainly should. Dr. Sachs is a giant among men, and I say that for two reasons. Certainly, he is physically very large, very tall, but also his impact on healthcare worldwide has been nothing short of monumental. Dr. Sachs is a doctor of internal medicine with a specialty in infectious diseases. His clinical practice is at the University of Geneva Hospitals. He is an assistant professor at the University of Geneva. He teaches and consults widely and also works with the World Health Organization. He is an extremely popular lecturer on hand hygiene and the control of nosocomial infections, but he is equally recognized for his work in system dynamics and behavioral science. He is author or co-author of a great number of articles, well more than 100, and really fascinating ones at that. You certainly know of the World Health Organization's My 5 Moments for Hand Hygiene. That, in fact, was Hugo Sachs's original concept. Earlier this month, more than 13,000 healthcare facilities around the globe participated in the WHO Save Lives, Clean Your Hands campaign that was based around the My 5 Moments program. A giant contribution indeed. Before Hugo begins, let me also acknowledge Gojo, the sponsor of this teleclass lecture. My thanks to those really great people for their sponsorship today and their ongoing support of the teleclass education program worldwide. Thank you very much to Gojo. So now to present Human Factors Engineering Applications for Infection Prevention and Control. Joining us from the Strasbourg Hilton in France, I am honored to present Dr. Hugo Sachs. Hugo, over to you.
Thanks to you, Paul, for this very kind introduction, and I would like to thank you warmly for having me on your program that is really well-known, and you, when you look through the program, you provide all these very interesting lectures to the wide public. So thanks a lot, and I will right jump in and go to the second slide and start by issuing a warning. Listening to this talk might result in addiction and frequent hilarious observations, so it's not only a risk, but it might be also some fun. And when you jump to the next slide, you can see why, no worries, it will even be very funny at times. Looking at design issues, and but actually by issuing this warning, I would like to say that this is the main objective of this lecture, to try to change your way of looking at our environment, be it physical or be it the processes we implement or be it the social structure we so often are involved in. Social structure that nobody designed, that just came about because we don't even think about the social structure being something that could be designed on purpose. In this lecture, there will be not a lot of infection control concrete applications, but I think that human factors is just one of those fields that not a lot of people know about, certainly not outside of the U.S. and maybe Canada, but it is a true knowledge base for anybody involved in patient safety and quality of care inside infection control or beyond. And I think if I achieve that, you might observe in your environment things that you haven't really realized until now that go against quality or against infection control of design issues, then this has been a success. So the part one of this talk, I would like to discuss human factors as a field. And I would like to start with the past and go back to the roots of this of the human factors engineering domain. And there is one person coming across when you look into the past. This is Frederick Winslow Taylor. You see a picture of him. And he lived between 1856 and 1915. And he came up with what he called scientific management. He was involved in thinking about what workers do while they do physical work and came up with a method to study this. He was very meticulous and very detailed in doing time motion studies, and they are known today, still done today, by timing exactly each movement of a worker while doing a job. Interestingly, he was also in 1881, a U.S. national tennis champion. Maybe this tells us something about movement and being aware of what that can mean. His contribution to industry, and I think it was Henry Ford who picked up on his idea and came then up with the idea of producing cars in a more industrial way, was not without critique, because looking in detail at what workers did and then redesign each movement was seen, and certainly rightly seen, as putting human beings into a sort of becoming part of the machine. And the next slide shows more of time motion studies. 1885, two American industrial psychologists, a couple actually, Frank and Lillian Gilbert, applied these time motion studies to bricklaying, something that was at the time the basis of all the constructions of houses. And you can see on the left, that was like, in those times, bricklaying was done. Bricks were shipped onto the construction site and just thrown on a heap, so they got sometimes broken, and they were lying chaotically around, and workers had always to bow down, get the piece, look at it if it was also in one, it was still in one piece, and even cut it in a square form again, and then use it to build the wall. And this couple, they studied each motion of these bricklayers, and you can see on the right picture, they put a real watch that actually timed milliseconds or hundreds of seconds, and timed each movement and redesigned the whole movement process. And they brought down the number of motions in bricklaying from 18 to 5, which over the whole time of building an entire building cut the time to do it maybe by 3. And this without putting more effort. They just shipped then the bricks in an orderly manner and put them in a fashion that you could reach underneath with your hand, not bowing down. They would be on the level where your hand was when you were standing up. And so the whole process was streamlined and much easier to do. So this was a real advantage by analyzing movement in detail, something that before that time was not done. Then we go to the next slide, and we see the Frankfurt kitchen that was invented in 1926 in Germany, in Frankfurt. And the architect, Margaret Schütte-Litowski, she was born in Vienna, and arrived in Vienna, and she became the first female student of the Vienna University of Applied Arts. She She joined then the architect Ernst May in Frankfurt when there was a shortage of living room for people, and Frank May was given the task to build a living space, functional and cheap to build. And she was involved in redesigning the kitchen. And she heard about the time motion studies and applied them to the kitchen work of women being, in those times, only women being attributed to this task. And she observed the work. She observed the work that has had to be done. And she observed the sequence of this work. And you can see in the next slide, she made plans and designed actually the environment according to the task. So the walkways would be reduced, and the objects and the tools that you needed to do kitchen work were displayed in a fashion to decrease actually the movements and decrease the work time. She did this also in the idea of freeing women of that time from housework so they could engage like men in more social interaction. But she was also criticized for having then women being alone in the kitchen and becoming a sort of factory worker on a production line, because the kitchens before were real living spaces and now they became very functional. But her idea was actually to free women, so maybe this was not, there was a side effect that she didn't anticipate. Next slide, still on the history of human factors. World War II brought a real boost to this field. And the problem at the time was that there was too high toll of pilots and planes. And I think everybody can see that this environment, this work environment of war pilots was really a difficult and challenging one. It is a really high velocity environment, challenging with all kinds of challenging tasks. And in this kind of environment, it is very it's crucial that errors can be reduced and avoided by having the planes redesigned. And so at that time came the idea to build interdisciplinary teams between engineers and this was new, psychologists and physiologists. They joined together to build planes that were more adapted to human behavior and to human limitations. They would look at, for example, the design of the display of the instruments, so they could also be read in dim light conditions, and they looked into the tasks in the sense of overload, of density of tasks, and on the contrary, also, and pilots would get bored and then not be attentive and make errors in that way. So this was the first time, actually, that machines were designed according to human factors, human limitations, and human skills, and not the other way around, that human beings had to behave according to the machine factors. So a completely new idea that was born under the need of having a more effective system between pilots and airplanes. Following that period, and this you can see on the next slide, there were a multitude of fields where human factor and this new way of doing things could be applied: transportation, environmental design, architecture, energy systems, management, office automation, and when you go to the next slide, oil field operations, aging is now a very important field for human factors, elderly being reduced in their capacity, and there is a huge challenge to redesign the environment to accommodate these reduced functionalities to still be independent and enjoy an interesting life. then the nuclear industry, farming, and so forth. When we go to the next slide, I don't know if you know the journal called Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, that the journal called Human Factors. It has not a huge impact factor, but it is listed in PubMed. And it there are all these human factor studies in there that are interesting. Also for the medical field, in fact, in the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, one of the biggest parts of technical groups is the healthcare groups, a very active group. And then on the next slide, you see there are now slowly also educational opportunities that are really specifically for human factors and integrate the different fields that contribute in these interdisciplinary tasks like psychology and engineering, for example, that are unified and make up an educational opportunity, for example, here to get a Master's of Science in Berlin in Germany. Next slide. I'm coming now to part two, the much larger part, and would like to talk about some human factors principles and their application to infection control. Next slide. So there are these high hazard industries that we know, like aviation, the most known and most obvious, but also the nuclear industry, as we have seen recently, a very risky business and very complex industry with risks that sometimes were maybe underestimated. And then also the whole domain of the future of our planet, including the environment pollution, energy production and consumption. And there is also the healthcare system. And these are all systems that are complex, that are built out of systems, and they get more risky and more high hazard if the systems, the subsystems they are built of, are highly interlinked, so that when there is a problem in one subsystem, it would concern all the other systems and can produce a major error. That's why they are called high hazard industries. I'll jump to the next slide. And this is really a turning point in the way we look at healthcare as an industry. The well-known report of the Institute of Medicine called To Err is Human, and this title actually says it all. Making errors is a human attribute. We are made like that. We do commit errors, and we have to live with it. I don't know if you have realized that this report actually promotes in a very intelligent way human factors as a design field. Human beings have all kinds of advantages, and until now nobody can build such an incredible self-healing organism with such great learning and behavioral capacities like human beings. But many advantages are bought by the fact that the system, human beings, we are not error-free. The good news is that these errors are to a great extent predictable, and they happen always in similar situations according to factors to which a human being is being exposed. But if we don't know these factors, this can lead to thinking that there is like an invisible hand pushing people to make errors always in similar situations. So let me read the text that I found in this report. Reading, latent errors or system failures pose the greatest threat to safety in a complex system because they lead to operator errors. They are failures built into the system and present long before the active error. Latent errors are difficult for people working in the system to see, since they may be hidden in computers or layers of management, and people become accustomed to working around the problem. This is a great topic, the fact that we don't often see what errors are sleeping in the system until a human being interacts with the system and the error becomes really an error that is visible. And then we tend to blame the human being because we cannot accept that we just make errors. And this hidden error, as this text says, may not only be physical design errors, but it might also be in layers of management or other structures like processes that we design. The next slide shows statistics of PubMed-listed publications that I found with the MeSH word human engineering, that is the MeSH word for human factors and ergonomics, and the term infection control between 1991 and 2010. And you see that according after this report that called for action actually to redesign healthcare according to human factors principles didn't have a huge impact on publication in that field. So we still have some way to go, and I think we still have the opportunity to make healthcare much safer by using principles coming from from human factors. When we go to the next slide, there is Fred Dust from IDEO, a design firm, quite avant-gardist, who gave a talk at TED, and I will try to play you what he's saying because I cannot play you the video, so let's try this.
Nurses are really good designers, far better, frankly, than a lot of the people that we brought into the room, and the reason they're good designers is because basically, everything is against them. The world has been designed against them. They have to undesign all the things that we put into the system. And they're doing it all the time. They're working around the system and designing things.
So I don't know if you heard what he said, but he was talking about how healthcare environments are not well designed, even have design errors in, and that he said in 2010, which is quite more than 10 years after the report was published. And he also says that there is an opportunity because people have, and he's talking about nurses, have design capacities that designers, professional designers like himself could tap into and do what now is called co-creation, co-design, to use the capacities and the insight of people working in the field actually to help designers to do a good job to end up with having a healthcare environment that is really designed to the need of healthcare workers. And this includes largely also issues in infection control, as we see in some examples that I will bring in a minute. The next slide shows people in front of a computer, and this I would like to try and see if you can remember or if you can see yourself working on a computer and being completely absorbed by what you see on the screen and not realizing in what an awkward situation or awkward position you find yourself in front of the screen. And then only 2 hours later realize that you have backache or that your leg is asleep. And this relates to our capacity of being very focused on something, but then forgetting about the whole environment. That's maybe the reason why we don't push harder to get the environment, our environment and our tools redesigned to our needs. The next slide shows this in a graphical way. You see the human being in the middle having a task to do, and then you see what is the possibilities of design around to make this task easier or have it being a barrier to really do this task easily. So you have the environment, you have the tools you need to do the task, and you have the design of the process. What is not in this slide is the social design, your connection to other people while doing the task. And maybe it's because in older times, long before civilization, people had simple tasks to hunting, simple social interaction, and they couldn't even think about redesigning the environment because it was nature and it was given, and it was hard to imagine that there could be any change. And to be focused on a task was really a survival advantage, and to not to take into account where you, what yourself are doing, and what in what environment you are in, but being very focused. But nowadays, this has completely changed. Our tasks have become very complex. They are not the same over generations. They are not even the same over a lifetime, and they increasingly they are not even the same during 1 year. So we have to learn all the time to do new tasks, and on the other side, our environment has become very man-made. So there is no reason why we should put up with an environment that is not designed to our needs. Next slide. There is in human factors the human-machine model as an idea how to look at this interaction between human beings having to do a task and using a machine here, but it could also apply for a tool or for a whole environment like an architecture or a town or a street. There is always a flow of information that goes from the human being to the machine. You manipulate the machine, you type on a typewriter, you manipulate buttons, and then the machine tells you something about the status, gives you feedback. Whatever you did, what the machine then changes as a status, and this is the output by the machine, and it is input into you as a human being as information. So there is an information exchange, and this could be manipulation or just visual information. And the idea in the next slide is that there should be a good fit between the two, and actually the good fit should come about by designing the machine according to the needs and the limitations and the advantages of human beings, which is not always the case today. It's rather the other way around, that the machine is built according to machine logic, and then the human being is meant to learn how to manipulate the machine. So in very complex systems, this necessarily leads to a lot of errors, because human beings, as we saw, are human beings and make errors. And you can either prevent these errors by having the design well done, or you can even design errors into the machine, and then people will do errors, and this is quite predictable. So let's look in some tasks and some design issues in our environment, and I would like to start with a very personal experience. Like many other man, I have to shave every morning, and when I'm in a hotel, I wake up in the morning and then I walk to the bathroom and I want to shave. And what I find as my environment is on the next slide. Here you can see that because, as Paul mentioned, I'm over the 95% percentile of the size of tallness of most people, and so my head sticks up over the mirror, and I can see my belly but not the place I have to shave my face. So this is clearly something that will result in me bending down and having a hard time to do a good job in shaving. And I suggest that you look around the hospital and think about the work environment and what we ask people to do in good quality, and see if the environment looks like this mirror for me for shaving, or if it's ideal in design. The next slide gives one of these examples. You might have seen this before. I often talk about it. You can see here two patients in one room. This is an architectural layout. You can see on the left the door and the sort of violet dotted line shows a nurse going to the first patient and the second patient, and the blue drops show the hand hygiene indications according to the 5 moments for hand hygiene that Paul mentioned. And you see here are actually 7 indications, 7 moments for hand hygiene of the different manipulations on central venous lines between patients and so on. And then you, if now your hospital would then decide to put the hand wrap dispenser outside the door in the corridor, as it often happens, the next slide would show the walkway this nurse has to do to comply with all hand hygiene indications, all 7 of them. And this is clearly something a human being would not do. This would be like nonsense. So quality would not be good by hand hygiene with this design issue. The next slide shows actually a work we were doing or are doing in our intensive care unit, and we were observing in a sort of time motion study nurses and doctors working around patients. You see here a bay with 3 beds with curtains in between, different objects like monitors standing around the patient. And we found out that 43% of all hand hygiene opportunities actually happen while healthcare workers walk over 5 meters. And this was not anticipated. So now we think that by placing hand wrap dispensers at the beginning of these walkways, we could profit from these 5 minutes already to do hand hygiene. Next slide. A fun book to read is the book Human Factor Revolutionizing the Way We Live with Technology by Vicente. And he actually talked about this human tech ladder, where you have human factors design opportunities not only on the physical level but also of higher levels like neuropsychological team levels, organizational levels, and even political levels. I find this a really nice idea that we could think about having politics designed so it would fit optimally the needs of human beings. Next slide. In human factors, a friend of mine, Chris Wickens, came up with this stage model of human information processing. This seems a bit complicated on the first glance, but it is quite useful to understand some issues that human beings have in while working and while living in an environment. You can see the truth that human beings have attention resources, they are not internal. You can in one given moment only come up with so much attention, and this can be saturated, and then you cannot take in more. While being trained as a pilot, I experienced this again very clearly, that sometimes when I was focusing on one task, this being challenging while learning to fly, I completely forgot something else, and I could easily understand that you cannot concentrate on everything at the same time. And this influences all other processes that you do by information processing. You have the long-term memory, you have the working memory, cognition, and then as a sort of a circle at the bottom of the slide, you can see that on the left there are sensory processing information coming in, at, for example, through your eyes. You have the short-term memory as an intermediate store. Then you have perception. You realize what you're seeing, which is something different than just seeing it. And then more to the right, between the different options of responses that you can do, you select the good one and you execute the response, and then it goes at the bottom back into the environment, and the environment gives you a feedback if this was good what you did, and you can realize if it was good or not by, again, having an input in your sensory system. Now let's go to the next slide. I highlighted perception, and I would like to talk about this because this is really the sort of the center of changing the view of how we humans function in relation to our environment and to the tasks we have to do. So the next slide makes this more salient. You have on the left a light with intensity, wavelengths, and so on that gives the color to the light and the objects. And then you have our eye functions capturing the light, having a sensation. And then it goes, this information goes in an electronic way along the nerves to our brain. And there happens something that is related to psychology, that is perception. And perception is not the same thing like taking in sensory information. Perception is something that when you treat the information based on experience, and a very good term, I think, is mental models to understand this, and the context in which you experience some sensory information. Mental models are actually necessary to understand the world, but it's a sort of a, it's like a picture of the world that we have in our head. And only when we have this picture of our world, we can understand the sensory information fitting with this picture. So it's useful, but it's also a limitation because it sort of gives us the limitation of seeing things or not seeing things according to what the mental model allows us to understand or not. The next slide says something about the quality of understanding our environment by top-down and bottom-up. Top-down would be we depend on the quality of the signal. So the next slide, also something that could be very useful also in infection control because we have to convey information to healthcare workers quite often. There is this concept of signal-to-noise ratio. You remember I said that attention resources are limited and we cannot take in everything. And if you want that something sticks out, it has to have a high signal-to-noise ratio because there is always information around that constitutes noise against the signal, the information you want to transmit. So in a physical way, to the left you see writing on a black writing on a gray background. This is a low signal-to-noise ratio. On the right side you see black writing on a white background, and actually human factors knowledge base tells us experiments that this is the best way to capture writing, to have it very dark, black on a white background. And on the bottom you see white writing on a black background that is not that has also a great signal-to-noise ratio, but is less good than black writing on a white background, unless we are talking about a dark environment where you have to where you don't want people to get blinded by very bright light. So this can be useful in a simple manner when you do your slides to show something in infection control, but the whole concept is much larger, and I found it always useful when I was thinking about giving a message to healthcare workers about infection control issues. I was thinking about what is the environment they are actually living in and to what kind of noise, in the sense of what kind of information they are exposed to, and where do I fit into this whole environment with my information. And usually then you sort of get more modest and you see that your information might not be that important seen from the point of view of the healthcare worker, and either you then make the information stick out more, or you just deal with the fact that you have to fit into a whole environment and look for a good space and a good moment in care where your information has a high signal-to-noise ratio. Next slide, bottom up, we see and hear what we expect to see and hear. There are expectations and context. This refers to the idea of having mental models to understand the world. And there is a very famous example for this on the next slide. This is the most deadly airplane crash in the recent aviation history in Tenerife when 500 people died in one accident. And you see an awful picture of a plane burning. It was considering two airplanes that crashed when a KLM flight took off in a fog while a second plane was on the runway, and there was a misunderstanding on the radio about the runway being cleared or not, and you can read here a part of the conversation of the first officer who says, "Hey, Roger, sir, we're clear to the Papa Beacon flight level 90, right turn out 040 until intercepting the 325, and we are now," and the captain says in Netherlands language, "We're gone, we're going," and then the Tenerife control tower says, "Okay," which wasn't really okay. And since then, aviation radio language has been very standardized to avoid confusion. So every word has been tested if it could be confounded with another word, confused with another word. And so the language has been redesigned on purpose to avoid this kind of misunderstanding. And actually, this airplane crash happened because the captain really wanted to go, and his mental model was that there was nothing on the runway, and because he was so urgently wanting to take off, he ignored more subtle signs that there might be a problem, which is typical for this, what could also be called intentional blindness, where you cannot see something that is hidden in plain visual field. So, next slide, you see the pictures of screen pictures of a sort of a serious video game on hand hygiene that we designed in Geneva. And we actually built in a very complex situation hand hygiene where two doctors are on clinical rounds and they discuss patients and try to make sense out of the symptoms of the patient. And then hand hygiene sneaks in on the same level as it does in clinical work, where you have a very complex situation in front of you and hand hygiene being on a very low level in parallel. And so we simulate this reality, and then you can interact with this software to put hand hygiene on the right moment. This is an example to simulate this complexity and destruction, and to simulate also the mental models doctors might have when they work. Next slide, the attention resources. I would like to tell you about an experiment that comes on the next slide, where you see the three numbers. This is called As the Door Study, and these authors, psychologists, Daniel Levine and Dalian Simpson, they found out in this experiment that people are so focused sometimes. As you see this man on the right, when you see a picture number one, you see that he is trying to explain an experimenter who was playing a visitor of a town with a map in his hand, who got lost, and he asked for the way to this man with the gray long hair. And then in the middle of the explanation, two other experimenters came along with a door, and they actually switched the person to whom the way should be explained, And the many of the people who want to help people to find their way, they didn't realize actually that they were talking to a different person. When you ask people if they would notice, 90% of people would say, yes, I would notice. So we also overestimate our attention resources and how precisely we observe the environment. But we are not very good at realizing what changes in our environment. Next slide, something about sensory processing and short-term memory. There is a next experiment, and I'll let you for some seconds look at the next slide with a series of letters, starting with a C, and then an I, and then an A, and then an F. And I let you try to learn this by heart, this sequence, and I will ask you to read it back in just a few seconds. And actually, there is an empty slide missing, so I cannot really do this experiment, but let's jump to the next slide and see that actually, this task would be very easy if you realize, and maybe some of you did, that this is a little story going that CIA, FBI, KGB were all looking for a certain DNA, and this was broadcasted on BBC in the UK and CNN in the USA. So if you find out about this, you can very easily memorize this in a very short time and keep it in mind for a long time. This is called, and this is the next slide, chunking enhances memory. And it is known, next slide, that human beings can only take 7 plus minus 2 items in short memory. Now, what would that have to do with infection control? Let's jump to the next slide. Here you see the writing about the 5 moments for hand hygiene, and you see the 5 indications. And this is already seems to be quite difficult to learn by heart. You wouldn't say so, but if you think back of the noise to the signal to noise ratio, clinicians have to take a lot of things in their head, so they don't pay attention to these 5 indications. But next slide, when you display it as pairs, so you apply chunking to memory to convey messages. You see there is a before and after patient and a before and after something that is humid. And then there is the after environment. So by chunking these together, you can probably enhance the learning effect of these 5 moments for hand hygiene. Next slide. The system environment and feedback is a quite an interesting issue in infection control. And next slide, infection control and prevention suffers from an action feedback disconnect. This is really the main difficulty we have in infection control in changing behavior to have a safe and high quality behavior. And in the next slide, you see a healthcare worker in a rose and black clothing, and you see a patient in a bed. And by looking at this scene, you would immediately think that there is nothing dangerous around here, but you just cannot see the pathogens that could pose a problem. You cannot see that there would be the danger of transmission of MRSA or another multi-resistant pathogen. Whereas next slide, in a situation like bungee jumping, where the risk actually for dying is not really very high in contrast to what could happen in a hospital, you would immediately have the feedback from the environment looking at this picture already that there could be quite a risk. So infection control could profit from this, knowing about this risk perception and what the environment displays to healthcare workers by making things more visible and tangible. And this is the next slide. And when then you jump to the next slide, feedback is a very interesting element in changing behavior, as we all know. And you see here an example not from healthcare but from traffic. You all know this feedback installations. They give you your speed and let you adjust your speed. This has been proven as very effective. And when you look at this picture, actually you don't see all the reality. When you look at the next picture, you can see that there is something that you didn't anticipate. There are people standing around and looking at this car driving by. Another example, next slide, coming from infection control, I picked out here just some example, is enhancing the perception of risk or a problem, infectious problem in the environment by using fluorescence markers in these publications to target standardized high-touch surfaces in hospital rooms. And this increased, as the next slide shows, the way people cleaned this environment, because then all of a sudden it could be made visible and tangible. And so this feedback increased then good behavior, because there was something to anticipate and to work on. Next slide, electronic hand hygiene reminder systems are another way to fill in the missing link, that we don't see pathogens and so we don't feel the risk and we don't see it. And such electronic hand hygiene reminders could increase hand hygiene in very special situations. Then I found recently, and this is the next slide, a time motion study analysis of healthcare workers' contact with patients and workers' hand hygiene in open and closed units, as published in the American Journal of Critical Care this year. So human factor seems as a subject penetrating now the infection control literature. And let's come slowly to the end and look at the next slide and look at some typical health, human factors evaluation methods that could become very interesting for us in research on behavior and behavior change and design of the healthcare environment in the near future. Human factors traditionally uses ethnographic analysis, which means that somebody hangs around, it looks at what is going on the ground for a prolonged time and takes note, which is really helpful in finding out where the flaws are in the system, focus groups and other qualitative inquiry. Then something important is iterative design, that something new is not just implemented, but that it is tested and retested and changed until it fits really the situation. Meta-analysis, subjects in tandem, surveys and questionnaires, task analysis. So you break down a task in all the different elements and you think about these. Then something very interesting is the think aloud protocols, where people tell you while they're doing something or reading something what they think about it. And user analysis using persona, a typical healthcare worker, imagining this and then thinking about what they would say in this situation. And the visit of Oz experiments, where you supplement a behavior of a machine by a human being, and so you can test it, the interaction with actually human beings. And with this slide, I would come to the last one that shows some pictures of the glider flying that I'm lucky to experience every now and then. And this whole involvement with aviation, the whole learning process, as I mentioned before, has been very fruitful to me to know more about my own behavior, and in an environment where you really don't want to make errors. Because here it's not about patients, it's about myself sitting in the plane. And so studying this, I understood quite well that design and behavior is important also in healthcare. So this brings us to the last slide, and I hand over back to Paul.
Hugo, thank you very much. That was a tremendous lecture. In fact, I believe that was your fourth teleclass lecture with us, all of the balance of them being available in the free access recordings library if people would like to go and listen to them. And I think it's probably your best. It's really fascinating, the applications of human factors engineering in infection prevention and control. And, you know, it's something that we can all see just about anywhere, really. I was in a hospital the other night, and I could see things that were essentially dysfunctional that, from a human factors engineering standpoint, just didn't work. But that's the way they were because that's the way they were. And I think we do that a lot in healthcare, don't we? In fact, we do that a lot in everything. Things are the way they are because they've always been that way.
Yeah, this is it. There is something about us human beings being completely focused on doing the job, and when we have a problem with it, we always blame ourselves or our colleagues, but we never see the whole picture, we never see the whole thing as a system, and we never get through to redesigning it. It's something in human nature, and it's not easy either to redesign it. That is true.
Well, thank you again, Hugo. I am really grateful to you for your participation today, and I gather from the fact that your email address is on the title slide and the second last slide that it would be okay for people to contact you directly if they have questions.
Yes, it is. I'm glad if I get feedback, and I'm glad to have new connections and talk about all these issues.
Well, that's grand. Thank you as well to Gojo for their support of this teleclass and of teleclass education, and to all of you. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'll look forward to speaking with you again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.